Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey folks, Mike Kilimecki here. Welcome to Food Talk this week. Rainy day here in Brooklyn. It's amazing. Spring, I don't know, spring sucks in New York City. Yesterday was gorgeous and today it's rainy and it's cold. Who knows? Summer's on its way, spring's on its way. That's what it is. We've got a great show today. I've got a couple of guests, one on the phone. He'll be with me live in just a moment. Live from Spain, Anthony Miralda, who was the proprietor of a restaurant that probably none of you remember because I don't know who listens to this show, but a lot of young people, I suspect. The restaurant was El Internacional. It only existed for 2 years, 1984 to 1986, in what was then Tribeca, a very different place than you would think of in terms of today's Tribeca. That's for sure. It was a combination of restaurant and almost performance art. Well, not almost. It was a restaurant that was doubling as performance art. And it came on my radar because there's a book that came out recently that was published. It's an art book. It was published by Art Publishing, DAP. And El Internacional, New York's Archaeological Sandwich, is the name of the book. They had a party out at PS, the MoMA in Brooklyn in the old school that I couldn't make. But I got a copy of the book and just fell in love with it. So he's going to be my first guest, second guest in studio after the break at the bottom of the hour. Will be one of the owners, Allison Nichols of Perilandra, which is a natural food store, a grocery store, an organic natural foods, whatever you want to call those things. But I love this because this is another sort of New York historical story. The store opened in 1976 in Brooklyn and has been going ever since. So that's, 40 plus years. In any case, let's get Anthony on the phone because he's talking to us from Spain and it's 10 o'clock in Spain, as I believe. Sir, how are you?
Hey, hi, fine. Very good. Thank you.
So, first of all, this book's amazing. I have to tell you, by way of background, I first moved to New York. I graduated the Culinary Institute in 1982, in January, and I moved here, and my very first apartment in January of 82 was on 310 Greenwich Street, which was a Mitchell Lama building. These were high-rise, affordable, middle-class housing in New York that somebody illegally was subletting me. So, like, my first impressions of New York as an outsider, because I was from Philadelphia up until then, was living in Tribeca for nearly a year, and it was such a different place back then. There was nothing. There was no supermarkets. There was no restaurants. I mean, there was like ethnic delis, like an Indian or Pakistani guy ran a deli where I could get like milk and toilet paper. And to get food, I often would walk to Chinatown to go shopping. Odeon, I don't think it even opened quite yet, but Odeon would be one of the real pioneers down there. And then Montrachet after that in terms of fine dining. But it was basically an industrial district that had, I mean, Bazzini Nuts was still roasting their nuts down there. Martinson's Coffee was still grinding and roasting their coffee beans down there. Harry Wells had a big distribution for eggs and butter. I mean, it was ending its life as a food distribution and manufacturing neighborhood. And unbeknownst to it, it was kind of transferring into what it would become next, which is those big buildings became homes for artist lofts and illegal lofts and all sorts of stuff. But there wasn't much going on. And I remember your building because it stood out so visually. So tell me, what possessed you? What made you do? I mean, I know you had a food background and an arts background, but give me the kismet of how you discovered the space, because I know it's in the book and I read about it. And because it had been Teddy's for years. That's what it was when I was in the late 70s and 80s. It was Teddy's, which was an Italian restaurant that had been Teddy's since the 40s with I think two owners on that the whole period of time. Then the last edition of Teddy's went out and you came in. How did you hear the space in the first place? How did you find it?
Well, let me tell you, when I moved to New York in 1972, I was really lucky because I was looking for a loft experience. I mean, coming from Spain, you know, a loft, it's that something, then, you know, you've been listening a little bit, but you don't know what it is about. So anyway, I went to buy some materials at Pearl Payne, who's a fantastic, it was a yep. palace of the artists with all the yep. ingredients necessary to do art, whatever. I'm going there and I'm seeing an announce, a loft for rent, 228 West Broadway. I said, that sounds good because Pearl Payne was so Canal Street,
yep.
West Broadway was on the corner. I'm going to see the place, wonderful place. Anyway, I got that place, I rented, wonderful. So what I had before in front of the space, I had the Teddy's. And this was, I guess, a destiny, good luck. I don't know what was that, but I could see from across the window from my loft, I could see Teddy's. So I saw all those 70s action there. A lot of limousines, a lot of little bit haunted, a little bit closed, a little bit, I mean, people saying, oh, well, you know, that place, you know, don't go, you know, you never know. That's probably a mafia place, whatever. I was young. I was, you know, dedicated to other things. But anyway, I was observing. And what's happened in 1983, I was looking for a space for a restaurant because Monseguin and myself, we decided to try to open a place in New York and try to bring from Barcelona the air and the texture and the taste of especially her restaurant, because Monse had a restaurant in Barcelona, a quite famous restaurant, very avant-garde. And we found a place for renting. It was, again, the same Teddy's. So that means I knew the place, but I'd never been inside. We went to see the owner, Mr. Sal Cucinotta. He tell us a lot about the place. He already sort of rented to other people, and the place went closed, whatever. And we got the keys. We got very excited when we crossed the door and we saw what was inside, because inside was, for me, was New York history. We saw many, many layers there. We start to check few things and take over the carpet and see under the walls, and we find some, of course, 50s. After we find a little bit more of mosaic tiles that were not from the 50s, so they were really from the 20s, from Europe, whatever. So that was part of our excitement and part, I could say, the way to work on this archaeological sandwich project. Start to the history, and from that do a place with contemporary food and contemporary ambience, if I can say.
But it was, I mean, I feel terrible saying this to you, but I mean, in the years that you were open, I was a young cook and I was broke and I was working 6 days a week, and on my day off, I probably slept as late as I could and did laundry. So I never, ever got to set foot in the place. I knew about it, but it only existed for a couple of years. By late 83, I'd already moved out of the neighborhood. But, you know, I'm reading this book and I'm thinking, like, this is amazing, because it's... It's so far ahead of its time. I mean, I think we're doing this radio show now from a place in Brooklyn called Roberta's that was kind of this crazy, casual, let's try and make great food in the middle of nowhere project. Very low budget, but the food was great, and it's, you know, kind of hipster-ish and young and fun. And, I mean, what you were doing, this is like 30 years ago, was really literally like almost food plus art plus graphics plus, at that time, modern technology. Because it's not a coincidence that the first Macintosh computer came out while you had that restaurant. Ridley Scott did the Apple TV commercial. Ridley Scott, the guy that directed Blade Runner, did the TV commercial, and you were using the very first Macs they ever made to create stationery, to print your menus out, to just do things with.
Well, let me explain you. I'm an artist, and my partner, Monse,
the chef, yep.
Yen, she's a chef, but, I mean, she has also a big a creative part. So what we want is to experience something interesting, we're not interested in just putting together a restaurant. I mean, you know, restaurants, there are thousands of restaurants. We're interested on work with food. I myself been involved with food since the 60s as an artist. I always thought that food is the best, the short way to connect with two people. I mean, it's like a straight line. You communicate to them. They have something to say because they recognize food is about survival, but food is also about everyday. It's about domestic. It's about ritual. It's about violence. It's about business. It's about designs. I mean, it touches everything. So anyway, we're interested on doing something special with food. But also, we're interested to, I don't know, bring some energy from our Mediterranean part, you know. This is something that we all have been captivated by the way that people here share food. I mean, the tapas. Tapas, yeah, were very, very unknown by the time. So unknown that the people confuse themselves and they call us the restaurant and ask them if there was a topless restaurant.
Right, so people were confusing.
Say, no, not topless, tapas, T-A-P-A-S. You know, they didn't know about that. So what is tapas? What tapas is just one way to communicate, to dialogue, to share, to just not getting the full plate, then after you can move yourself, you know. No, just something, a taste, and you share that taste, and you take another one and another one. I mean, it's a way, it's about conviviality, and it's about, so as I said, it's about sharing. So anyway, that was one of our intentions. It also, I mean, as an artist, of course, I've always been extremely interested about how, you know, the image can sort of introduce connections, information, links to what you're eating. So the idea of the video tapas, videotapes. I was working on video, and the first idea of the restaurant that we are planning was having a video tapas, so a videotape bar. Anyway, El Internacional, that was something else because the place was something already very much designed by itself. You know, there was very strong character, so it was not about putting a video tapas. We had a video menu. We had the first video menu there, but yes, the image was very important. The moving image, the aesthetics, the textures, the not only the food but also the environment, and of course this sort of working with these different steps of 50s, 20s, 50s, 60s. So the way then we plan to do this intervention to this change in the facade, you know, camouflating the facade and bringing that sort of pattern that was coming back from this 70s thick stone that they put on. So it was just a piece, and it was perhaps the right time, and we had the right people probably, and it was right away became extremely popular and famous.
Yeah, it's incredible. So let me describe what we're going to get you. We're going to get into the restaurant in a second, but so just by way of history, this was, as far as we know, the first tapas bar in New York City, and you were really 30 years ahead of your time, or 30 some, in terms of like the small plates, because in the last 5 or 6 years, everybody in New York's doing small plates. It's as if nobody wants to do appetizer, main course, desserts anymore. All these menus are divided up into little bites, bigger bites, littler bites. You know, it's crazy. And you were doing it 30 years ago. The only the only Spanish restaurants I remember back then were like in the Village, I think, the Sevilla Inn and El Quijote in Chelsea.
Exactly.
And that was it. I mean, everything in New York was Italian or French, period. Maybe a couple of German and Swiss places here. So you were a complete outlier. But so 219 West Broadway is a very small building that I think used to be two brownstones that were at some point combined. But on both sides of it were buildings that towered over it. So right from the street level, you had these two big buildings, then like a little building. And as you said, you painted the front. It kind of looks like, I don't know what it looks like. It looks like fake stones. You're right. It looks like how people used to have, that was a style in the 60s. So it kind of looks like a Dalmatian print or an animal kind of print of black and white on stucco with a big awning that comes out that says Tapas Bar and Restaurant. And then on the roof at some point, not from the opening, but a little later on, you installed this like 3-ton, it looks like, it doesn't look like it, it's a copy of the crown from the Statue of Liberty that sits on the roof and hangs out over the street. I mean, that's crazy.
No, that's just this is just a proposal for getting the people some ideas. I mean, you need to stimulate people. It's not only feeding people. People can be fed everywhere. You know, food is survival. We all have food. So people that came to an international, yes, they were first confused. They ask many, is that an art gallery? Is that a museum? Is that a restaurant? Because they were really start to see first the facade, seeing the, you know, we had this wonderful display case. There were different artists working on different interventions. So they were set away, prepared for something else. So this was very much our idea. And because, you know, you need to give people some chance to think about some other things. I mean, what is food? Of course we need food. But food is connected to so many interesting other things. So this was part of our idea of printing the newspaper.
Right, you had your own newspaper, right?
Newspapers, right. And there were about not only the history of the play, but also about what, you know, food has to do with culture or the history. And also, this was very much part of our intentions on the menu. We had this, as you mentioned, you know, this wonderful Apple program. So we print ourselves our menus. So there was a one way to a certain bring this other and change in other elements, other ingredients to food. So and that was, you know, enough to make people to feel the place comfortable. And of course people love the place, so we had big, you know, names and wonderful people. And but more than the wonderful people, what is interesting is that why, you know, Andy Warhol ordered couple of times he came the same, you know, Butifarra Mungeta, you know, Beans and Butifarra, who's for us is a very classical modest and country type of food. So, you know, with the food, you got people involved and you get them, you know, reaction. So that was very, very interesting. And especially, I can say, it was interesting for the team that was working there. We had a wonderful team, and most of them, many of them, I can say, they were Spaniards from Catalonia. They were, you know, just making their life and starting their life there, finishing their you know, school and starting a new career there. And so for many of them, and this you can see on the book, because on the book you have all the memories, you can see, you know, what they said about the place. You know, there was for them very important. They marked their life, you know, they meet people, they find out about, you know, then the connection with art and food and performance, you know, food and fusion, you know, this idea of an international, the fusion of different styles, whatever. So that was our idea of creating a platform, a stage, you know, a restaurant as a stage.
Every bit. So you'd come in, there was a section of the floor that was it was flags, international flags. There was that huge fish tank that kind of divided the front room and the back room, that's epic with bubbles and that thing that you brought up from Brazil. I think you flew it on your lap on the plane. And then describe this. It's like, because this is really another, like, you would step off of West Broadway and it was an otherworldly experience. And yet everybody, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Andy Warhol, I mean, they filmed an episode of Miami Vice in the restaurant or outside, which is, I mean, that was like the hottest TV show in television at that point, right? But talk about this, the Columbus Trophy Bar, because I've really never seen anything like this. Actually, the whole restaurant, I've never seen anything before or after like it since. But the Columbus Trophy Bar is this crazy bar with these statues and vertical iconography, columns. You describe it. I mean, you've got garlic hanging, you've got salt cod hanging, you've got peppers hanging, you've got jamon hanging. You know, you have like three tiers. You describe it to me, because you have these. Also, these, there was kind of the centerpiece of the restaurant. You walked in, the bar was to the left, all those beautiful tiles behind it, but it was just these crazy columns filled with liquid. Describe it to us, because it's like, it's otherworldly.
Yeah. Well, that was the idea. You just come in, you had this type of carpet, you know, on your feet, you see all the countries of the world. This is not something very usual. You know, usually you don't walk on flats. Mm-hmm. And after you could have, you know, you could see some information there. You go to the left, Metro D stand. It was very, very, for me, symbolic. It was like a kind of melting pot. Icon, and right away you had on your left the bar, the Columbus Trophy Bar, or on your right you had the first dining room, the turquoise dining room. So, well, the bar, yes, bar was like a. I love trophies. I mean, you know, the aesthetic of the trophies, and because it's like, you know, this a grandiose architecture, but it's made of aluminium, you know, anodized aluminium, bright colors, fun, with a little statuettes on top. So I've always been very fond of trophies, and I collect a few of them, whatever. So the bar, it was transformed as a trophy bar, and on top, of course, Columbus. Why Columbus? Because we have in Barcelona a monument, and it's, you know, it's a quite an important one. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I understand, you know, a lot of people don't like him because he, you know, he is a symbol of the conquest and conquista, but he's there, you know, he's part of our city, and I was already, by that time, in 1984, when we opened the restaurant, I was already working on a project about possible romance and a future marriage. It came, you know, between two monuments, the Christopher Columbus Monument in Barcelona and the Statue of Liberty of New York. So, anyway, my idea of Columbus, the icon of Columbus, and also the Liberty with the crown, as you said. You know, they're already in my mind. So anyway, the bar was quite interesting, because already you had all those display of tapas, but the same tapas you had it in the dining room. I mean, you know, people could eat, sit down and take also and eat the tapas. So, and the bar was, of course, very colorful. Our star drink was the Blue Margarita.
Right.
Blue Margarita was invented there. We, you know, that was part of our, I can say it, you know, our home stamp, you know, like people asking for, well, let's see. But what's happened? We had also Blue Margarita on a Peron. I mean, Peron are typical from Catalonia.
Yeah, it's Perona, a crazy, the drinking,
me,
the thinking thing, right.
Drinking vessel,
right.
Who has a very special, perhaps you can explain better than me, a very special shape. And for us, you know, it is a totally a popular icon.
Let me try and explain. Let me try and explain the shape.
You don't find the Perons in a high good restaurant. You find Perons in a sort of a popular places. So we had Perons there, so the people already could spend the time. We had beautiful music. Bob Jones prepared wonderful soundtracks. So that was enough for creating the good atmosphere. But of course, after you could see. On the back on your right, you could see the open kitchen. So again, another icon, because open kitchens, you know, they were not very, very common in that time.
No, you were one of the first.
And that great 50s sort of kidney looking ceiling, wonderful blue turquoise, and we did, of course, we found some of those things there, but we transformed completely. I sort of had to, you know, during 3 months, during the summer times, there was like my palette. I was walking there and mixing colors and bringing things, and so there was the, you know, like making a piece. That's it.
Yeah, completely. I mean, this is a really like a bespoke one-off restaurant. And let me just describe what a Peron is to the audience that's listening. So it's a drinking vessel that almost looks like a kind of a modern day decanter. It's kind of U-shaped, but not exactly. You pour the wine into the big end, which is then going to be the handle, and then you lift this whole thing up, and it holds a fair amount of liquid. We're not talking about 6 ounces or 10 ounces. It holds more than that. And then it comes, the drinking end is a little, almost like a fine, it's like a conical tube that gets narrower. So technically, you could probably hold this thing up at the end of your arm, tilt it, pour a stream of wine into your mouth. It's like very fun, very kind of tongue-in-cheek, but that's how you did it. And I think at one point you even had a Peron Olympics.
Exactly. But you describe it very well. Yes, the Peron Olympics was one of our hit events, but it was also, you know, Peron is something that you pass to one, to each other, you do the next person. So it's, again, is another tool of conviviality, of sharing. But we had also some other good events there. You know, we had
the crazy one, the Statue of Liberty thing. You had the high school band. You had the street kind of closed. You had it. There was like, you had the Statue of Liberty top draped. You had high school bands. You had people outside. What was that about? That was like.
Well, that was a way to open the restaurant to the area, to the neighborhood.
Neighborhood, okay.
You know, this were young neighbors. I mean, you know, Tribeca was just born. You know, people start to know the name, but it was all those few artists start to get ready there and buying lofts. I mean, you know, I'm saying buying lofts. When I came, we just renting lofts. The things start to change a little bit, just a little bit. But many people who were there already didn't know about it. So what we want is to open the doors. We create for that a sort of a decor, like a cape. We dress the facade with a beautiful long curtains dress, red with some elements black and white, and was sort of combining with the facade. And we had also this cape or dress involving in a certain way camouflage, if I can say, the crown itself. So we had this wonderful band who came, and all the waiters did a processional piece with the perrons and the trays, and we went all around the block. And when we came back in front of the restaurant, they went on top, and they sort of opened symbolically the crown, and we start to serve to the table, the big table on the street, and everyone was there, and we had perrones with different juices and also margaritas. And we had, the interesting thing is that we use the old Teddy signed letters we use as a trays, as a platform for serving the food. So all this was combining a sort of a open air and a public celebration.
It's incredible. I mean, what a scene. Yeah. So again, the name of the book is El Internacional, 1984-1986, New York's Archaeological Sandwich. We didn't get into that part, but I mean, it was quite the thing. And kudos to your chef, really. First tapas bar in New York City. So many for small. First small plates restaurant, one of the first open kitchens I certainly have ever heard of. And I know she was really fastidious about ingredients. She was seeking out a Galician bread and found a bakery in Jersey that made it for her. Really interesting ingredients. Brian Miller reviewed you for the New York Times. Gail Green loved it from New York Magazine. Your customers included people like Andy Warhol, Jean-Michel Basquiat. This was at a time when you could actually see. I remember when I used to take the subway, Keith Haring's work was in the subways. He would just chalk up. There was like all those advertising signs were vacant because the subway was a place nobody wanted to be in. No one was going to pay for advertising. So Keith would bring his chalk down and just mark them up. So, I mean, you could have actually gotten a knife and scissors and walked home with original Keith Haring's from that era all over the place. But it was David Byrne, Robert De Niro, Umberto Eco, Michael Douglas, Lorne Michaels. I mean, you had, you know, the New York arts and shakers coming as regulars.
Yes, there was also because I think, as I mentioned, it was just, I think, the right time, you know. And also there were certain circumstances at the same times. I would like to say, you know, there was a Palladium which just opened
right.
at the same time.
Right, the club.
Aria just opened a little before us. So there were some sort of energy on the air. You know, this was not ourselves alone because, you know, people stay until later in our place, in our bar, and after going to the Aria, you know, 2, 3 a.m.
Yes, ecstasy was a drug of the time.
So
people were doing
like,
blow.
I think that's it. That's the mid-80s, and that's, I don't know if that's still possible to do.
No, it's completely changed. No, it's
had changed. We know.
Yeah, we had
and,
those.
Also, there was, you know, there was many things happened since that, and many people disappear, and there have been ads, there have been, you know, many. So it's all this together who also makes these memories much more strong.
And then you end the book, sadly, that, you know, the restaurant closed after 2 years, and then a few years after that, as is so often the case in New York City, it was a small building. Clearly, it could be knocked down and built up. You could acquire air rights from surrounding buildings. So the end of the book is actually the discussion for the vote from the community board to allow the building to be sold, demolished, and go up, which is kind of a sad coda to an amazing place. But it's a great book. It's a great story. Thank you belatedly for coming to New York. My only regret is I never got a chance to walk in the door because I was a little too busy trying to make a living back then. But it's a great book, and it's a great snapshot, and you guys were really, really pioneers. Thanks so much for coming on. Pleasure talking to you. Take care. Enjoy life in Spain.
Well, I'm very glad you like the book. I think the book has a lot of all those things things that we're talking about. I mean, it's supposed to give you, if you read it, if you look at, to give you some of those energies of the time.
Yeah, totally.
And a special, give you some samples of the aesthetics also, who were very particular. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you so, so much. Take care. Again, the name of the book is El Internacional, 1984-1986, New York's Archaeological Sandwich. I'm sure you can find it online. It's great. It's an art piece. It's worth it. It's a great snapshot into the first New York that I knew. I moved here in 82, and that's what I moved into. Stay tuned. My next guest is in the studio. She'll be live with you in a second. Allison Nichols, who is one of the partners in a store that's been in Brooklyn for years, a natural food store, Perlandra. We'll talk to her about what she does and about the history of that store. So it's sort of a historical show today. Forgive us, but that's what it is. We'll be right back after this message. Hey folks, Mike Kalameko here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable sourced olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavitas living in Rome, Colavitas living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I recommend you try it as well. Hey, welcome back. Food Talk here. Mike Kalameko. I am your host. I am here weekly doing the show for the time being anyway. Anyway, Allison Nichols is my guest. She is a partner now in a store that's been in Brooklyn, really kind of a mainstay, Perlandra. And we'll get to the name of that because wasn't that a C.S. Lewis book?
Yes, it is.
That's such a weird, geeky reference. I'm like, why?
It is.
And it's a science fiction. It was like a trilogy science fiction thing, and that was the second book.
Yes.
Okay,
yep.
I guess you could have called Lord of the Rings or something, but that wouldn't have been so good. So this store is pretty epic because it's been around since 1976.
Yeah.
It was opened by Steve Hoos, who was 26 at that point, unemployed. In 1976, I was 2 years out of high school. And so the early 70s on the East Coast was kind of the beginning of the whole, I don't want to say like hippie health food movement, but for lack of a better term, that's pretty much what it was.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of came from the West Coast East, as so many things in America do.
Yeah.
Because the West Coast is unbridled and doesn't have tradition, so most every food thing and lots of art things start there and drift their way here.
Yeah,
where
exactly.
We're much more ingrained. But I remember as a high school kid, so early 70s, in these kind of wealthy, educated towns outside of Philadelphia. I lived in West Philly, which was none of the above. Mm-hmm. But I went to school in the suburbs on the main line, so we all had cars and we'd drive out there. So in towns like Bryn Mawr and Wynwood, and there were these, you know, little, like, macrobiotic stores, and some of my friends would have hippie moms who would be, like, making their own granola and stuff. So
yeah.
You guys kind of go back to the beginning of that health food thing in the city.
Yes.
And you've survived this long.
Yeah. It's going to be our 41st anniversary on the 17th of this month.
Crazy. You came on board in 2002, is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And with a bunch of degrees, you have Will you tell it? I'd want to.
Yeah. I'm a nutritionist. I have a degree in biology. I have a master's in nutrition. I have an MBA.
That's all?
That's all. That's all for now. We'll see. Who knows what the future holds?
I dropped that of college after 2 minutes. So you never know what happens. So that's crazy. And what led you into food? I mean, the nutrition is obviously, that's a rudder. So you've been thinking about this forever.
Well, I was going to school while I was working at Perlandra. I started working at Perlandra when I was 17. And I had been vegan for years prior to that.
Well, that was my next question.
Yeah.
So So keep going. Keep going.
Okay. Sorry. So I'd been vegan for several years. I stopped eating meat when I was 11. I decided I want to be vegan when I was 12. I read Diet for a New America, John Robbins. Great book. Still holds up. Read it a couple years ago again. And I thought working at a health food store would be a good fit as a vegan. And so I was hired there as a cashier right before I started school and just stayed on. Kept working.
High school kid. I love it. What made... So you were a bit of an outlier back then. So, I mean, there had been... Well, I guess when I started doing radio in 05, 06, we started to sort of, you know, tiptoe around the vegan-vegetarian thing. Because it occurred to me that the statistics that I kept reading, that I would, if you Googled stuff, to, you know, the government, the official statistics, seemed to be so off base, because I think even today, the government official estimates of vegan vegetarianism is like 3% of the country.
Yeah, it's really low.
And it seems like if you live in this town,
yeah.
I mean, a third of the kids I know, or a quarter of the kids I know, that are under 35. That's what they are.
Yeah.
So I just can't imagine. Like, we're not talking about like closet vegans.
No.
We're talking about numbers that don't reflect a reality in this town.
Yeah, I mean, if you're on the coasts, if you're in a big city, I mean, you probably know a lot of vegans.
It's super common.
Yeah,
and restaurants are now making huge carve outs for them and have to. I mean,
yeah.
You're not going to survive.
Yeah,
I mean, my days in the kitchen, if a vegetarian, God forbid, when they came in and they would order, it would just be like, well, give them some tornado carrots.
Pasta primavera. Broccoli.
Yeah, it was whatever.
Always the pasta primavera.
Right, whatever the four vegetables we had plus something else. And now you could, you know, eat like a king doing just vegetable-themed stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, when I was first vegan, that's what it was like. You know, it was like there was a tiny health food store where I grew up, and there were some vegan items. And coming to Brooklyn and going into Paralandra, it was like...
Paradise.
This, yes, it really was paradise. You know, it was just everything I could ever have wanted.
So that's a great story. So you really started out as a kid and worked your way up the whole way.
Yeah.
Your partners now. Tell me about the... If I had been in your boots or in Steve's boots, you kind of owned that market for a while.
Yeah.
And then Whole Foods comes.
Yeah, sure.
The Time Warner, actually Chelsea was the first to... I remember when Time Warner opened, because I work out uptown. And I knew about Whole Foods, and I thought, I'm going to go check this out. It was literally like the second or third day. It's the entire ground floor footprint of the Time Warner building. It is huge.
Yeah,
it was one of the first real supermarkets where you can actually push an honest-sized cart through honest-sized aisles.
I mean, it's a suburban-sized supermarket.
Correct, which doesn't exist here. But there was a line out the door because they had exceeded their certificate of occupancy. So it was like when 30 people came up the elevator, they let 30 people down.
Yeah.
By the second week it was in business, between the retail and the food preparation, because it has a huge sort of cooking thing, it was the highest grossing Whole Foods in the country.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably been that way. And they've done nothing but grow since then.
Yeah.
So you're up against them. So how does that work? How do you navigate?
Well, and it's not just Whole Foods.
No, it's not just
Whole
Foods.
It's the entire landscape of food.
Correct.
You know, it's online orders. It's Blue Apron.
Right. I go into ShopRite, some Dookie supermarket down by me in South Jersey, and they actually have this expanding organic section.
Oh,
and I'm
sure.
Like, are you kidding me?
Every mainstream grocery store has a pretty extensive natural food selection. I mean, in Brooklyn, you can get, you know, almond milk at any bodega, you know, any
basically.
Literally anywhere you are, you can get natural foods.
And then there's the Park Slope Co-op, which is like a whole nother story we won't get into.
Yeah.
But so putting your MBA hat on, what explains your survival all these years in spite of what has really been ramped up competition?
I think we just do a really great job. You know, we're really good critical thinkers. We're always looking at what the customer experiences and what we can be doing better, what we can be doing better than other people. Our selection, it's a really, really well-curated selection. I'm the buyer, and I'm also a nutritionist.
That was my next question.
And so everything goes through this vetting process of me. You know, I look at it and I decide whether or not it meets our standards, which are exceptionally high. And we have customers who've been shopping with us literally since the store opened 41 years ago, who continue to come in sometimes every day, sometimes more than once a day. I see people. I'm not kidding. There are people I see three times a day.
That's New York. I mean, I shop for food every day. So I don't know why I have a full-size refrigerator.
Yeah.
I could have one the size of this cup. I mean, basically, I don't know what I'm eating for dinner until I wake up that day and go to the market and find out. So that's kind of how a lot of us live.
Yeah. So, I mean, I see these people all the time, and they trust us. They know what our standards are. They know what the vetting process is. They know that there's a human that they can talk to if they have a question. They know they can come and talk to me, you know, that I'm out walking around.
At one point to this point you're making, I think it was in 2010, all the products that you're using that are prepared products, not in-house, you can control, but prepared, you made sure if they were using soy, corn, canola, or beet, which is, these are super common ingredients. So these are lipids, these are fats, these are sweeteners.
Yeah.
That they were from organic and and GMO productions.
Non-GMO sources,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
So starting in 2010, any new item I brought in the store, so that's not just what we're preparing in-house, that's any new item that I'm bringing in to sell on the shelf. Soy, corn, canola, beet, those are the most commonly genetically engineered crops. If you have a product that you want us to sell and it has a soy, corn, canola, or beet-related ingredient, it either has to be certified organic, because certified organic means non-GMO, or it has to be non-GMO. And you have to be able to show me the paperwork to prove that it's from, you know, a non-GMO source.
What a pain in the ass you must be to vendors.
But you know what? I have vendors.
This is not the easy knock on the door.
No.
Hey, look at my frozen empanada thing. You're like, no. Nah,
and our reputation precedes us. People know what our standards are. But they also want to be in our store because customers know what our standards are. People want to shop with us because, you know, we have those exceptionally high standards. And I have companies like Brooklyn Deli, for example. They make this amazing tomato achar, this Indian condiment. She started using non-GMO canola oil.
Because of you.
Because of us. Brooklyn Whatever, they make pickles. She started using organic vinegar because vinegar, distilled white vinegar, comes from corn. Corn genetically modified. So she switched to organic vinegar.
Right. They're really cheap, like those gallons of industrial white vinegar are whatever they can make it the cheapest from.
Yes.
In this case, it's corn.
Exactly. And that's basically what it's, you know, if it's always, you know, the cheapest is soy, corn.
In terms of regular labeling regulations, if I walk into a supermarket now and I want to buy canola oil because I use it to saute, and I spin that bottle around, do they have to disclose?
Nope.
They don't?
No, and there are a lot of people have been trying to change that for a long time, but there's very powerful lobbyists that are fighting that.
Our labeling laws in America are a joke.
Yeah, and in the EU, you can't sell genetically engineered foods. It's like...
Yeah, I know. I used to sell in Europe and I used to sell here, and it was like day and night. Like, they really kind of give a shit about everything. Even how it's handled in between, like from the truck to the warehouse to here, refrigerated and this and that. You can't call this if it isn't that in America. It's like, whatever, dude.
So I feel like that sort of underscores the importance of what we're doing.
As vetting.
Yes, exactly. You know, we're doing that for you. That's important to me. That's important to, that's what our store's about.
You talk about the customer, because that was one of the questions I had written down, because you've been there now 15, 16 years?
Yeah.
So, and as someone who's running a business that's that old, you really have to be nimble and light-footed.
Yep.
So that's kind of my question, so how do you... I mean, I've seen businesses, I've been here that long, where the business sort of went through its natural life cycle because it was selling to the same aging customers who it got to the point where if you picked up the obituaries, they were losing customers on a daily basis and doing nothing to appeal to a younger set. Yeah. What have you done to be able to turn that around as the dynamic of the retail? Because that's not easy.
Yeah.
I mean, turning a retail store around, like they always say that expression, but like doing a U-turn in a battleship,
yeah.
it doesn't happen. It's a big moving thing. You've got momentum. You've got a customer base that likes you for what you are.
Yeah.
How do you change and appeal to what must be a cross-generational younger audience?
Yeah. Well, I think staying true to what the original vision of the store was, which was to really provide the highest quality foods. And so this is what I do. This is my whole life. Anywhere I am in the world, anywhere I'm in the country, I find really cool specialty items and we sell them. You know, we're the only place on the East Coast that sells a number of items. So you can come in our store and every week we're getting new products. You know, we have this very dynamic selection of products and I think that's really exciting. I hear people get excited about the products that we sell and, you know, how they never know what we're going to have. But we are really flexible. You know, we're very responsive to the feedback that we get. And being a smaller business, that's one of the benefits of being a smaller business is you can, you know, have a conversation with a customer and think, oh, that's a great point. Let's change that now. Here's how we're going to do it. And by the next day, you know, we've changed the way that we're doing something.
Right, the advantage of being independently owned and having...
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. You know, I am accountable to, you know, my partners, my employees, my customers. I don't have shareholders that I need to be pleasing all the time. So that gives us flexibility to make the best decisions that we can.
Which is the trouble with Whole Foods.
Precisely.
I want to say, I mean, it was really, when Whole Foods first started to open up, I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. It's never going to work. I was just so, you know, a bunch of patchouli scented Birkenstock wearing hippies from Texas are trying to do this shit. And then the thing grows by 15. And I know grocery sucks. Like the average profit in grocery, whether you're talking ShopRite, AMP, Acme, Food Import. You're talking about like a 2% profit and a growth rate that's below that.
Yeah.
And Whole Foods is growing at 10% a year for 20 years.
Yeah.
And just making money hand over fist. And then they've hit some bumps in the road now.
Yeah.
And because it's now it's all driven by stock price.
Yeah.
Which means you're beholden to those nuts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, and that's the big difference. I can make the best decisions for my business. I can make the best long-term decisions for my business. Decisions that might not be the most profitable in the immediate future, but that I know are the right decisions for Paralandra.
And you're also just that right size where you can be hands-on with everything. You're not
with
looking
everything.
Right, you're not looking to open up 15 new Paralandras up and down the East Coast in the next 6 months.
No, you come to that store, you see, you know, it's me and Roland and Steve, and you'll see Roland and I out on the floor stocking the shelves. Sometimes we're mopping the floor. You know, we're out doing stuff.
It's like
truly hands-on.
It's like the original Fairway. When I came to the city, I was living up there, and they had that one store on 75th Street, and it was just like, it was them and Citarella with the D'Agostino's in the middle, and that's all you needed. You got your fish at one place, you got your cheese at the other place, you got your, and then you know, get toilet paper at the D'Agostino or cooking oil. But it was good. But the owners were always there, and it was, you got that sense.
Yeah, I mean, one of us is there every single day of the week, and we are really super hands-on. And that's, I think that's what people really appreciate. You know, the standards that we have, and the standards that we have just keep, you know, it keeps expanding. I'm not bringing in new products with carrageenan in because I'm skeptical of the safety of that ingredient. You know, I don't see other places being as responsive to that sort of information as we are.
Dive down on that. Give me a little bit of bore down on that ingredient and
on
why.
On carrageenan?
Yeah. Where would we find it? What is it used for?
Okay, so
and why are you suspicious?
Sure. So it's a seaweed-derived thickener. So you see it in puddings, you see it in ice creams. I actually have, you see it in tons of stuff. I actually have an ice cream vendor who took it out of their ice cream so that we would sell as ice cream. There's evidence, I mean, there's pretty clear evidence that it causes inflammation at the very least. And so many chronic illnesses are caused by inflammation. Why would we want to consume a food additive when there are alternatives that we know can cause inflammation? So that's my perspective on it. And I was validated pretty recently because the National Organic Program actually voted to disallow it from the program a couple months ago. Right now, it's an acceptable ingredient in the National Organic Program, but not anymore.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of breaking news.
Yeah.
How do you feel about all those crazy sweeteners out there that are sugar substitutes?
I mean, I feel okay. You know, stevia actually comes from a plant.
Right,
you know,
you
can grow stevia.
Right.
Things like xylitol, they come from birch trees. When there's like a clear source, I can bring it back to the original source. I feel okay about that. Things like Splenda, I don't know. We don't sell anything like that.
Figured.
There's
been the terms organic and natural always kind of drive me crazy.
Yeah, people use them interchangeably, but they are not interchangeable.
They're not interchangeable. Yeah. So you kind of do, but the trouble is the FDA is kind of the gatekeeper for this. Yes, no, maybe?
No.
Who is? Is there like an outside USDA?
The USDA, yeah. The USDA oversees the National Organic Program.
So what's the definition now of
certified organic?
Yeah.
Yeah,
start
okay.
There.
So if a product is certified organic, it means there's no synthetic pesticides, no synthetic herbicides, no synthetic fertilizers, no GMOs, no irradiation. Now, if you're talking about an animal product, in addition to that, it means
sees daylight, walks on the, goes out of, can't be done.
You know, there's not like a daylight provision, but they do have to, I think they have to have access to grass.
I get so cynical when I hear this because I could just see like companies like Purdue.
Sure.
Once they, I mean, IBP sells beef. IBP sells beef to Whole Foods.
Yeah.
Iowa Beef Packers. One of the monstrous big three.
Yeah.
That somehow they, when I guess in the late 90s, early aughts, they looked at Whole Foods growth and said, you know,
we got to get in on that.
Sure. And sure, they've got guys that went to Yale Business School.
And so
they would sit, the Whole Foods people would sit down with IBP, and IBP would say, what do we have to do to get on your shelves? And if it was take some stuff out or just, you know, slightly jiggle the feed and remove some, we're going to do it because it's too much business we're giving up.
Well, I think for something like animal products, for example, so the animals can't be treated with antibiotics. Can't be treated with hormones, and their feed is certified organic. And I feel like that's significant. Even when you have huge agricultural operations like what you're talking about, that's significant. You know, reducing your dietary exposure to chemicals, genetically modified foods, antibiotics, that's worthwhile to me. I mean, my child, I have a 2.5-year-old. The animal products I give her are certified organic. That's my rule. You know, I'm not as strict about everything else.
Yeah.
But the animal products I give her are certified organic.
I remember flying to Europe years ago in the 90s when I used to subscribe to the New Yorker, and it was a great typical New Yorker piece, you know, 50,000 words, but it was about antibiotics and animal feed, which is kind of new to me.
Yeah.
And then, they are the largest buyer of of antibiotics in the country. So forget you going to the doctor feeling like you're sick. And no. They're sold by the ton to slaughter to guys that are raising cattle, guys raising pigs, guys raising, and they just lace their diets with it so they don't get sick. Ends up in your food, and we end up with this like residual effect of why do we have these super bugs now?
Yeah,
because we've been throwing antibiotics at everything.
Yeah. So I mean, why wouldn't we do what we can to reduce our exposure to? I mean, you know, we only sell certified organic produce at Paralandra. Why not do what you can to reduce your exposure to unnecessary chemicals? And the people who are growing your food, do your part to reduce their exposure to unnecessary chemicals. And you know, that's a piece of it.
I think you can correct me, but well over 60% of the public believes that it's better for your health to eat organic and stay away from the pesticide. Like, this isn't like, again, Birkenstock, patchouli-smelling hippies.
No, it is not anymore. I mean, we certainly have those people, and I love them. I mean, I am one of those people. As soon as it's above, you know, 60 degrees, I wear Birkenstocks. But, I think people are becoming very aware of the long-term impact of, you know, chemical and antibiotic exposure.
The term natural, what's that mean?
There really is no official term or official meaning for the term natural. Now, if you're talking about meat, there is that is regulated. So if a meat says natural, it can't have any artificial colors, flavors, or preservatives.
But they can pump water into it. It could still be all sorts of things.
That's all that it means. That's the only capacity in which the term natural is regulated.
So
that's it.
Kind of means nothing.
It really does mean nothing, which is why you have to shop at a store like Paralandra, where you can walk up to a person and say, what are your standards? And we'll say, you know, no artificial colors, no artificial flavors, no artificial sweeteners, no hydrogenated oils, no corn syrup. You know, and then we've already talked about our GMO standards,
which is crazy,
protein and standards. So that's what natural means to us.
Right.
You know, and there's nobody regulating it. So you need to know where you're buying your food from.
Where's your production kitchen? Because you have this huge menu daily. You do breakfast and lunch every day.
It's in the store.
Downstairs?
Nope.
Like
it's what you see is what you get.
So there's a workspace in the back that's just open.
Yeah. It's an open kitchen. We're actually doing a renovation. We are actually going to be filing our permits in the next couple of days. We're going to be tripling the size of our kitchen. We're going to be doing a renovation that I'm very excited about.
Does that speak to the volume of food that you're selling in prepared foods?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we've always done really well with prepared foods. Everything that we sell, everything that we make is vegan, even though, again, we're not a vegan store. We have organic animal products. But all of the ingredients that we use, if we can get a certified organic version of it, it is. And that's really what sets us apart. You know, you can go to places like Whole Foods has a really extensive food bar. I'd be really surprised if anything that they're using is organic. And literally everything we can get, it's organic. And that's how we're going to continue.
What percentage, if you don't mind me telling me if it's proprietary, that you cannot answer.
Okay.
What percentage of your gross sales is coming from the prepared foods part of your program?
A substantial percentage.
She's being demure.
Yes.
Okay, I like that. Well, no, it's not surprising to me.
I would like it to be more, which is why we're doing this expansion.
One of the things with Whole Foods Time Warner that blew them away was like, because they have that sit-down space that's kind of underneath the escalators on the way to the front wall.
Yeah.
And it was just, they were just bowled over by the fact that so many New Yorkers don't really feel like cooking, want to feel like they're eating well, want it when they want it, how they want it, and that means like now and put it in a box and weigh it and get me out of here.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I mean, we're going to have a hot food bar. We're just really going to be hugely expanding our operation. We're going to have a really large case with, you know, 80 different grab-and-go items every day, hot food bar, soups, sandwiches to order, big coffee bar, and it's still, you know, it is going to be all certified organic and vegan and food that you can feel good about eating. I mean, I've been eating this food for breakfast, lunch, and sometimes dinner daily for 15 years. You know, and I feel great about it. It's like I see the people who are making it. I'm involved in the development of the recipes.
Because you're a nutritionist.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really rare to have.
That was
one of my questions, but you answered yourself. So that's one of the hats that you wear as well as being everything else in the store.
Oh, yeah. It's, we literally have our hands in everything.
And you're vetting everything from salt to sugar to fat to, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what we look at.
Have you been to Rouge Tomate, the restaurant?
No. What is that?
Oh, well, you should take her sometime. Okay. It's good. We've got an in-house nutritionist.
Do they?
It's mostly vegetarian, vegan.
Yeah.
Wine list is great. Pascaline Lepeltier, Master Sam. She is a monster. Wine list is great.
Yeah.
A lot of natural wines. So, 60, how big is the store? How many square feet?
6,700 square feet.
6,700 square feet, which is a pretty darn big footprint for New York City.
Yeah, it is.
Address?
175 Remsen Street in Brooklyn Heights.
7 days a week.
Yeah, 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day. We do online ordering. We've had online ordering since 2005. How about that? We'll deliver anywhere in Brooklyn, same day. Monday through Saturday.
And holiday specific stuff too, because that's such a big deal these days.
Yeah.
You doing Passover stuff? No.
We get some Passover stuff.
But it's a little bit different because you have like religious and kosher and that sort of another line we're crossing.
Yeah. We certainly don't specialize in it.
Yep. Where's the U.S. stand in terms of organic farming or organic consumption versus Europe with like Switzerland, Austria, Italy, these countries kind of leading the way?
You know what? I actually don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I don't know off the top of my head.
But we've been making strides.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
And the story, so it's a bunch of prepared foods to go. You've got what they call beauty products, all that sort of
stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, we're a full service store. I do all of my shopping at Paralandra. I mean, we have, you know, a really large organic produce selection, a great grocery selection, you know, fridge, freezer, bulk, a climate controlled bulk food room. That's outstanding. That's great. Yeah, I mean, health and beauty aids, shampoo.
So you're
vitamins.
Like a Brooklyn one-off version of what Whole Foods always wanted to be.
Yes. We mean it. We mean what we say.
I like that. I love that. I love that. In this world of like, we've become such cynics. I just don't believe anybody's anybody's story anymore. And you know, God bless Whole Foods.
Well,
I know
they were
supporting this station, but God bless them, whatever.
We do the right thing.
Where'd the name
That's
come
what
from?
We're about.
Why did he pick that name? Now we got to get to that. So it's crazy.
Sure. So it's Paralandra. Every now and again, somebody actually comes up. They're really excited about it. I got an email from a fifth grade teacher 2 weeks ago saying, we're reading Paralandra. I just wanted to know if the name of your store came from the book at my class. So Steve, the founder, is a big sci-fi fan, and he read the book. And Paralandra is the name of a planet, and it's a very lush green planet. And that the description of it sort of described what he wanted Paralandra to evoke, this lush green, healthy. That's what it was about.
Well,
it's really memorable. People hear it and they remember it. They often can't pronounce it correctly, but they remember it.
So how lucky. This is great for you. So you started just as a kid.
Yeah.
As a high school cashier 16 years ago, and now you're a partner, and there's no end in sight because you guys are the baton's kind of being passed because Steve's gotten older. Steve, at some point, wants to step back if he hasn't already. So, I mean, you're doing your dream. You're living your dream.
Yeah, so it's, Roland and I, we're running the show.
Congratulations.
That's what we do. Yeah, we love it.
One more time, the address in Brooklyn?
It's 175 Remsen Street in Brooklyn Heights.
Gorgeous Brooklyn Heights. Thanks so much for coming on. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, fighting
this is wonderful. Fight. Yeah, that's what we do.
Be good. I don't know who's here next week, but something tells me, I don't know who it is. Well, I'll let you know later on. We'll go on the website.
Okay.
We'll find out. Take care. Thank you guys for coming out. Keep up the good work. Thank you. Guys, I'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.